UConn media specialist in university communications. He's also the guy that runs the UConn website, which is pretty complex, and we'll talk about that as we go along today, too, because there's some pretty good UConn histories things on the UConn website also. Mark Roy, former WILI news director, our guest this morning, who seems to have a passion for the history of the University of Connecticut. Mr. Roy, welcome back. Good morning.
Thank you. Good morning.
Thanks for coming in today. What is this passion you have for the history of UConn?
Actually, it's something that grew as I was working at UConn. I was an undergraduate at UConn in the early 1900s. And
I think we had a mic failure there. What was the year again?
I was an undergrad at UConn in 1970 to 1974.
Worked at the radio station there, too,
I did. Yeah. That's right. That's how I got my start in radio. Was one day walked into the radio station and thought, this looks fun. Well, as an undergraduate, there really wasn't much that you learned about UConn history. And as I learned later, there was a period where the university and its students really didn't care that much about its past. And some might have even been embarrassed about the fact that it started as a small agricultural school. But I found that the more I worked for the University of Connecticut and learned more about the institution, that some very interesting things happened in its birth and in its growth and development over the years, over the decades. And it's now approaching, in next month, its 128th anniversary.
1881. So what happened in 1881? What changed in 81 that was not there before, that is there now?
Well, actually, there's a backstory that goes all the way back to the early 1860s. But 1881 is when the legislature approved a bill that created the Storrs Agricultural School. That was in April of 1881, and the school opened in September of that year. The backstory is that there was a school in Connecticut that was in West Cornwall, Connecticut, the Creamery School, which was an agricultural school for boys. It operated from the 1840s until the mid-1860s by a gentleman named Theodore Gould and his father. It was a private school. It was not a public school. It was not state-funded. But they went out of business during the Civil War period. And Theodore Gould was very much involved in agricultural interests in the state, very much involved in any kind of movement related to the industry of farming in Connecticut. And Gould was pretty much a supporter and cheerleader of doing something to have some kind of school in the state. Well, that dream that he had would not come until 1881. But over those years, he met a couple of gentlemen who were businessmen who had been born and raised in Mansfield, Connecticut, but were businessmen in Brooklyn, New York, and their names were Charles and Augustus Storrs. Charles and Augustus were born in the 1820s. Charles was involved in, I guess you would call the import and export business in New York City and in Brooklyn, and went bust during an economic downturn in the 1850s and ultimately repaid all of his debts and started his business again. And then come the 1870s, 1880s, when wealthy people like Andrew Carnegie and others were becoming philanthropists, the Storrs brothers were persuaded that there might be an interest in Connecticut in having some sort of farm school.
When did that portion of Mansfield become Storrs? Because it was named for those guys, wasn't it?
It was named for them, but it was not a location until there was a post office established in the late 1880s after the Storrs Agricultural School had been started. So the Storrs Agricultural School was not known to be in a place called Storrs. It was in Mansfield, and still to this day is in Mansfield. Storrs is a section of the town of Mansfield.
So Storrs Agricultural School then, University of Connecticut now, what was the evolution of the name change since the school began in 1881?
At the time it was started in 1881, there was absolutely no idea that it would ever become a university. In fact, there was resistance to any kind of state college or state university in those years. But the evolution of the name is that in 1893, through an act of the legislature, it became Storrs Agricultural College. And there's an interesting story there that we can talk about a little bit later about how that came about in 1893. Has to do with battle with another institution in Connecticut known as Yale. The next name
change had been around a little longer.
Which had been around a little bit longer. The next name change was in 1899 when it becomes Connecticut Agricultural College. It's growing. It's no longer just a regional little school. They're considering it a state college. So it's Connecticut Agricultural College from 1899 until 1933, when after years of students and alumni supporting the idea, it becomes Connecticut State College. Now, that name is probably the one that had the shortest. That name lasts until 1939, when it becomes the University of Connecticut.
Now, you said you had another story about the Storrs Agricultural College. We can hear that now.
About it from 1893?
Yeah.
Sure. Well, when the federal land grant bill was passed, what's known as the Morrill Act, named for Justin Morrill, a Vermont senator, supported schools in the states, and in Connecticut there was no public education, no public higher education. There were no colleges, there were no universities. There were what we called at the time normal schools, teachers' colleges, which became the Connecticut State University system, ultimately Eastern Connecticut State University, etc. But there was nothing that at that time in the 1862 when the Morrill Act was passed in Connecticut that was public higher education. So Connecticut gave land grant status to Yale University, which established the Sheffield Scientific School. Well, by the 1880s, there was some concern in the state that over a 24-25 year period, Yale had only graduated 7 farmers from that program at a cost of about $25,000 each. That was a considerable amount of money back then for educating an individual. And so in a move that was really more anti-Yale than pro-Storrs Agricultural School, the Grange and other agricultural interests persuaded the legislature, and the legislature approved a bill to change the Storrs school to a college. The curriculum didn't change. It was the same faculty, same students, and was not accredited, but it suddenly became a college. The fight with Yale was such that Yale sued, and a court case took a couple of years to be settled, and in 1896 they were awarded damages. And the damages were $156,000, a considerable amount of money, because they had lost funding. However, that ruling from a 3-judge panel also said that the state of Connecticut, while it was at fault in this particular instance, could name any institution it wanted to be its land-grant college. And so that stuck with the Storrs Agricultural College as land-grant.
Now, I know back in 1881 there was not a women's basketball program, probably not a men's basketball program either, but where I'm going with this is that in 81, wasn't it just a college for boys?
It was just a college for boys, boys 15 to 18 years old. It was not even a high school. Some of the boys went on to graduate from high school after graduating from Storrs Agricultural. But it did have a rather rigorous program for the students. I just wanted to let you know a little bit of what they did. Their curriculum was agricultural practice, which included tillage, drainage, manuring, irrigation, handling of field, garden, and orchard crops, use, care, and repair of farming tools, and I'm reading now from the original prospectus, implements and machines in breeding, rearing, training, feeding, and use of livestock, including cattle, sheep, horses, swine, and poultry, agricultural science, chemistry, physics, botany, zoology, English, including reading, speaking, and essay writing on agricultural topics, arithmetic, elementary geometry, and, quote, such simple carpentry and smith work as are useful in New England rural life. Now, that's quite a curriculum for what is not even considered a high school in 1881. That was their morning program. In the afternoon, they were outside. They were aiding in the harvest of crops, digging and drawing of stone and laying them into wall, and they carried out minor improvements, drainage of the swamp, and we can talk about the swamp later. In winter, they cut wood, they built an ice house, and they did indoor work in the laboratories. And basically, their original routine was they arose with the rising bell at 6:30 in the morning. They had breakfast at 7. They had prayers immediately after breakfast, because prayers and going to chapel was mandatory back then for them. And they went to the Storrs Congregational Church across the street. Lectures and recitations were from 8 until noon. They had dinner at 12:15. From 2 to 5 is when they did the manual labor. So they worked 3 hours a day, 5 days, probably 6 days a week. Supper was at 6 p.m., and they had study hours 7 to 9, and then it was lights out.
By the way, this information is not just in Mark Roy's head. It's on the website. I'm reading, kind of following
yes.
along here as Mark's saying it. It's at the site uconn.edu/history, and you basically wrote that page, I'm guessing, right?
The website was developed with other people yeah. on the staff, too, but a lot of the material that I wrote over the years for articles in the faculty staff newspaper are appearing on those pages, yes.
Where did they live, based on what we know of the UConn campus now, and where were the classrooms?
All in one location. And that's part of the backstory I talked about.
So you just roll out of bed and you're in class.
That's pretty much it for the first decade or so.
Well, I'll tell you what. My days, I lived in the jungle and I have to walk all the way across campus of Social Sciences and Humanities, which is now our home in Monteith. And, geez, back then you were in class when you woke up. That's great.
They were in an old building that had been an orphanage. The orphanage building, the Connecticut Civil War Orphanage, had been built in the mid-1860s by a gentleman named Edwin Whitney. Whitney had started a school for boys, not an agricultural school, but a regular school for boys, and it had burned down. And he decided to rebuild. Well, around the same time, the state was looking to locate an orphanage for orphans from the Civil War, Connecticut soldiers who had died and their wives had died. They decided to give the orphanage rights to Edwin Whitney, and he built a 50-room wooden structure, three or four floors that included living quarters for the orphans. But when the orphans all had grown up and moved away in the mid-1870s, the property in 1878 was sold to their neighbor across the street, Augustus Storrs. So less than 2 years later, in 1880, Augustus and Charles, who we talked about a little bit earlier, had been persuaded that there was a need for an agricultural school. Augustus donated 170 acres, including that first building, to the state of Connecticut for the Storrs Agricultural School. Now, the building had 50 rooms, so they turned them into the dorm space for the students, and they only had 12 students back when they opened in 1881. It was also classrooms. It was also apartments for their faculty, and their faculty was a principal, an assistant principal, and a professor. That was the faculty at that time.
What was the weather like the day UConn opened back in 1881?
On September 28th, 1881, it was extremely warm that day. It was around 80 degrees in Mansfield, a record 90 degrees set in Boston that day, according to the records that I looked up a couple years back. So it was a very warm day, what they considered Indian summer in late September. And they had started on time, but the official ceremony was delayed because of the death of President James Garfield. Garfield had been assassinated, was shot on July 2nd, and lingered for a number of months, and passed away in September, largely due to infection, because his doctors kept sticking their finger into his wound and caused infection. But an interesting little, and here we go off on another thing here, the phone exchange for Storrs was Garfield.
In fact, they did a lot of them after presidents. I think the Willimantic 423 exchange was Harrison. Benjamin Harrison. So, and that was Garfield until I think about 1970 or something like that, and they changed over to the numerical prefix.
Mid-60s, late-60s, yeah. When they went away from letters and went strictly with numbers for those. But that's kind of a leap there. But another weather-related story is that in the blizzard of 1888, the faculty member assigned to go pick up the mail at Four Corners to walk from the campus to Four Corners and bring it back. Did it that day of the blizzard, and that was Benjamin Coons, who was at the time principal of the school.
And you've also got some great stuff on your website about what life was like before, during, and after the Hurricane of 38. There's some great stuff. All the trees that came down from that. There's a lot of good stuff on the UConn website there. The opening of the Storrs Agricultural College in 1881 was delayed a week. Is that because of the presidential?
Right, that was because of Garfield? The president had passed away, and they delayed the official ceremony until early October. And the ceremony was held at the Storrs Congregational Church. They had invited guests from the town of Mansfield. Some legislators came. Clergymen came to visit, townspeople came, and they demonstrated their laboratories and such as they were at the time, having only been open for a week.
I found this on your website, too, that at the end of the first trimester, an unnamed Chronicle, quote, correspondent made a visit to the fledgling school, and his report was published December 14th, 1881, as the first semester came to a close. Today, I visited the State Agricultural School at Mansfield. Does that mean he didn't get the name of the school right? It's not the state. It was the Storrs Agricultural College.
It was Storrs Agricultural, but that's lowercase, and he was referring to
a
state agricultural school.
At Mansfield, had the privilege of dining with the family. It is a pleasant household in a commodious and sightly location. The principal, Solomon Meade, sits decorously at the head as paterfamilias, cheerily yet orderly and bountifully dealing out the viands. I don't know what a viand is.
That's the meal.
Oh, thank you.
Yes.
Learned a new word this morning.
Isn't this the way Chronicle correspondents right now?
Yes. It's like reading sports stories from 100 years ago. The method of writing is totally different.
Very formal.
And the password is viand. The table is also graced by Professor Armsby and wife and Professor Benjamin Coons. Did he misspell it here?
Yes, it is. It's K-O-O-N-S.
Yeah, but he spelled it C-O-O-N-S. While the dozen of young men in attendance upon the school will fill up the flanks of the stout table in the cheerful dining room.
And that was in the building that had been the Civil War orphanage. And it was at the corner of what is now Route 195 and North Eagleville Road. And passers-by who drive by in their cars or walk by will see a large stone slab there with a plaque on it. And that stone slab was one of the steps to that school building. It was torn down in 1932, and the plaque was put in place. And it basically states that the original school building was on that site.
The story goes on. I'll cut to the end here. It says, in my several visits there, I may say that the impression received is that Mr. Storrs did well in conceiving the plan and in giving the farm, and the state does well in accepting and occupying it, and that lads intent on farm life can hardly do better than making use of the drill here afforded. That's from the Chronicle back in 1881.
December of 1881. And in April of 1882, I just happen to have this information in front of me. The following was in the Chronicle. The Storrs School at Mansfield has just entered a new term with 8 or 9 scholars. They'd lost a few students. Solomon Meade, the principal, has resigned and returned to New Haven, leaving Professor Armsby at the head of the school. The institution is a complete fizzle, and the legislature has simply thrown the money away that has been spent there. This is less than 4 months after that glowing report of how wonderful things were at this new little agricultural school.
It seems to have done well since that time, though.
It has. Yeah. It has. But it has gone through some rough patches, as we all are right now, as a matter of fact. But by 1883-84, there was discontent about whether it was successful or not. Meade had left. He'd had disagreements with the Board of Trustees. Armsby, who was his assistant, became interim or associate or acting principal. He left before the end of 1882, and Benjamin Coons was the sole remaining original faculty member, and he became the acting principal and then became principal in full and served until 1898, and his title was changed to president later on. But in the mid-1880s, there was a commission that examined whether this state school should continue and whether it should be moved to another location, including another location in Mansfield. They were looking at the Stearns Farm as a possible location to move the school, but they were also looking downstate at other locations. Ultimately, they came to the decision that it was successful, that it was doing fine, and let's leave it alone for now. But this would come back a number of times over its history, again in the 1890s, and even up until the 1920s and 30s, when it was starting to become the University of Connecticut. And it was largely because of a feeling that Connecticut shouldn't be supporting public higher education. And again, that thing I talked about at the beginning about there wasn't even a conception of a state university. That was something that Connecticut would not consider because they had so many private schools. And that was the rallying cry of the opponents of any kind of state college or state university was, well, look, we have Trinity, and we have Yale, and we have Connecticut College for Women. Why would we need a public university? Well, the point is that most residents of Connecticut couldn't afford those colleges.
Of those 12 or 13 original students, do we know where they were from? Meaning, are they from eastern Connecticut? Did they come up from New Haven or Hartford? Did any of them pay out-of-state tuition back in 1881?
No, there were no out-of-state students at the time, and there wouldn't be for a few years. But into the early 1890s, we started to see a number of students come along who were from out-of-state and even from out of the country. By the end of the 1890s, there were students from Germany and even a student from Japan. I do have a list somewhere, and it's just not committed to memory, but most of the students were from Connecticut. A few were from the Mansfield-Coventry area, but some were from western Connecticut as well.
Maybe you can look that up for later on. Earlier you'd mentioned you had a story about draining the swamp. First off, where exactly was the swamp, and secondly, how they drain it?
The Great Swamp was located along Route 195 toward the southern end of what was the campus at that time, and in the early 1920s, they decided to put up an earthen dam and made a little lake, and these days we know it as Mirror Lake.
And that continues to flourish and very popular amongst the ducks. Mark Roy, our guest this morning, giving the history of Yukon. In fact, he is not only an expert at the history of Yukon, he actually has a book. How'd that book do, and is it still available?
The book, there are still copies available at the Yukon Co-op. It was originally published in 2001. And there was a reprint in 2005, so there are a few copies still out there. Did okay.
It's almost more like a pictorial history, isn't it?
It is. It was a photographic history. The publisher, Arcadia Publishing, their niche is to do local histories with lots of photographs. And so I had already had an opportunity to look at many photographs in the university's archives because of the stories I had written for the faculty staff newspaper. But when this came along, I sat down and spent many days going through all of the photographs in the collection at the time and came up with these. A lot of heartbreaking decisions about what to take out and what to leave in, and put it together, put it in chronological order, stitched together some of the articles I'd written so we had some narrative in there. And if you start at the beginning and go to the end, you get a pretty good sweep of the history of the university up until 2001.
When's book two coming out?
No plans for a book two at this point, pretty much because we did the whole thing in one book. But there is a newer book that came out, written by Bruce Stave, a UConn history professor, emeritus history professor, that came out for the 125th anniversary, Red Brick in the Land of Steady Habits, a narrative, not a photographic history, very well written, very well researched, and very interesting stories in there about the history of the university, largely from the 1930s to the present. That is because there was a 50th anniversary history that was published in 1931 that was written by Walter Stemmons, who was then known as the college editor. And he started what essentially today is the university's communications office. He was hired around 1918 and served for the university until his retirement in 1954.
We did have Bruce Stave on when the book came out, and there's all kinds of great stories that he told, and they're in that book as well. There is a history quiz of UConn on your website, ucon.edu/history. I will take that quiz live on the air in our next segment. What I also wanted to set up here was what I plan on playing out of the news. In other words, when we begin our program again, following the news at the top of the hour, and that would be the original UConn fight song as premiered by Fred Waring and the Pennsylvanians. Wasn't that on national radio?
That was on NBC Radio.
Yeah.
But in 1939.
It's not the one people know now.
No, it's not.
It's not the UConn Husky fight song. It's not the UConn alma mater. What happened to that song? Why did it not survive?
The university had a number of songs at the time. Many colleges had different kinds of songs. And that song was written in a promotional thing that Fred Waring did. He would write new songs for colleges based on suggestions from students. And a student at UConn suggested this. And he wrote the song, it premiered, and it was sung, and I'm not sure exactly why, but there was one of the lines is, mush away, mush away. And perhaps by the end of the 1940s, a decade later, students might have been tired of singing that. But what happened really is that Herbert France, who had been a faculty member since 1932 and started the music department, wrote what we now know as UConn Husky, and that song started to take over. And by the early to mid-1950s, that's the song that students sing most often in relation to athletic events.
One thing that's cool is that you have a copy of that Fred Waring and the Pennsylvanians on your website. How did you get a copy of that?
We were given permission to use that song by the archives at the University of Pennsylvania, where all of the Waring archives are located.
Tonight's new song written by us at the request of Connecticut University, whose colors are white and blue, whose athletic teams are called the Huskies. Our compliments and best wishes to Connecticut University go with this presentation.
March away, march to the glory of blue of sea. Oh, the Husky of Connecticut will bring us victory. Rock on the rolling hills beneath the blue Connecticut hue. Proudly stand, small and great, come to that next day. Rise and wave your hand, shout throughout the state that here you are. A loyal Husky will come to Connecticut hue. We won't say die. We'll try and try to win with all our might. So fight, fight, Connecticut hue. Fight, fight, fight.
Fred Waring and the Pennsylvanians with the original version of the Yukon Fight Song, premiered on national radio by Fred Waring and the Pennsylvanians. And it's available to play, as I just did, off of the Yukon website. This one's off the advance portion of the Yukon website. We're talking about the history of the University of Connecticut this morning with Yukon media specialist and university communications, Mark Roy, our guest today. It's kind of fun hearing the old Fred Waring version of that. What do you think, in your opinion, the reaction would have been nationally to hear Fred Waring do a song for Yukon? I would think that if I'm in Missouri or I'm in Nevada or I'm in Arizona, I'm going to say, hey, Fred, you want to do one for us too?
Well, it was quite a thrill, and a couple of students did go down to New York City where the broadcast was on Friday evenings from the NBC network, and students were so thrilled they also gave a Husky puppy as a gift to Fred Waring some weeks later on the program. So it was a big event for what was now the University of Connecticut, and the name had changed just in May of that year of 1939, and they previously had been known as the Statesmen when they were Connecticut State College, and so that's one of the reasons why they came along and came up with a mascot such as the Huskies.
Well, it's funny too to hear that song, very much big band, very much 30s, and somehow I can't hear the UConn fan base singing that, say, at Gamble Pavilion or at Rensselaer Field. The changeover to the one that they sing now, I think, was a pretty good idea.
And it refers to Connecticut U, and at no time in our history have we referred to it as Connecticut U.
Well, I think it was more for poetic license there to
it was.
Kind of have it to work out there. And they spelled it the school C-O-N-N-E-C. And it's funny that, you know, when I was in school, and maybe when you were too, you learned the song, but I don't think people sang it. Nowadays, not only do the fans sing it at games when the band is playing it, but I have been in the UConn locker room football after a win. And after the coach has gotten in and talking to the team, they, as a team, including the coaching staff, they break into the current UConn fight song, you know, Connecticut UConn Husky, and they do the whole go fight, win thing and all. It's kind of cool to see.
It's
not something that a lot of people have access to, but that's sort of what I do there. So that's what's happening as far as the fight song is concerned. How about the origin of athletics, the early days of athletics at the University of Connecticut?
Well, we had talked earlier about how in the first decade, students spent their afternoons doing manual labor. And by the late 1880s, they were also getting involved in other kinds of activities. Student clubs started to come about, and also they started to play some athletic games. One of the first was baseball, and we have a photograph from the early 1890s that shows the baseball team for Storrs Agricultural School. Also around that time, they were starting to play football. And the third sport on campus at that time was a game that was played on the ice. And it was very interesting to learn a little bit about this, that they were not playing hockey. It was similar to hockey, but in the United States, what came about was a game called ice polo. And they used a ball instead of a puck. And we discovered this from one of the photographs, and also from the early write-ups in the student newspaper that started in 1896, The Lookout, that would become a Connecticut campus. And they talked about the polo players going onto the ice. And at first, that's a little jarring. You're thinking of, how did those horses do that? But it was actually an American game called ice polo. And by the turn of the century, 1900, after some American college teams had played teams in Canada, where hockey had developed, they'd started to like that game a little bit better. probably a little bit easier to manage that flat thing instead of that ball that they were trying to hit around on the ice. So polo went away and hockey took over. But those were the first three sports on campus. And again, it's around 1889, 1890 that they start playing these games.
And UConn men's basketball began back just after the turn of the century. And I know from T.C. Carmel's book that was similar to the book that I wrote about the men's program, she wrote about the women's program, she said there actually were women's basketball games going back 100 years, even though you kind of think of it as being something more in the last 30 or 40 years or so as far as the real intercollegiate nature of the sport.
The men's team played a game in January of 1901 as an experiment, and apparently it took. they beat Wyndham High School in a game, and so basketball was in stores to stay. Just a year later, in the winter of 1902, the women started a basketball team. They were in their first dormitory was known as Grove Cottage, and it was located just about where, near where Gully Hall is today on the campus. And they had a gymnasium in their dormitory. And so I think the men may have practiced there as well. I'm not sure because there's no indication that there was any kind of gymnasium in the other buildings on campus. But anyway, the women started in 1902 and they had a team for a number of years. Actually, the men didn't have a team for a couple of years too around the 1910s to somewhere around there. I'm not exact there, but depending on whether they had a coach or not. But the women's team right up until the 1930s or so was an active team year after year.
And the early days of the UConn men's program, besides Wyndham High School, they also, I know, played the Willimantic YMCA. The schedule has since improved somewhat, you know, with the Big East and national championships. Those are the early days of hoops at the University of
Connecticut. Well, they played high schools, they played local schools, et cetera. And I'm talking about the sports beginning in the early 1890s, but the athletic division at UConn does not count the beginning of sports until 1896. And that's when the first collegiate league was started with other agricultural colleges in New England. That's when the league started. That's what they date the beginning of athletics to.
Which almost seems to evolve into what we knew as the Yankee Conference, because you were playing teams, other land-grant colleges throughout New England, and of course that went the eventual way of the Atlantic 10 and some other incarnation since that time, but of course UConn left that and has become quite successful in the Big East. And we should also tie in Holly Armory to this too, because that's where some of those early basketball games were played. People know about the Fieldhouse because the Fieldhouse still exists in a different form now than it did back in the days when, you know, Fred Schaible and Dom Perno and D. Rowe were coaching there. But before those days, they were playing basketball at Holly Armory, which for the folks who need the geography lesson here, is a little bit off to the, I guess it's the east of what the current Babbage Library is right now.
Right. Holly Armory was built and opened in 1915 and was the center location on campus. There were even town meetings held there, and an annual agricultural fair by the town of Mansfield was held in Holly Armory. They had basketball games, they had graduation ceremonies, concerts, and play productions were all done in that building for many, many years.
Now, you had earlier said that you had a listing of the hometowns of the original 12 or 13 students when the school opened back in 1881. And you've got a lot of paperwork with you. You couldn't find it then, but you've since
right,
located
I've got it now. I had not committed it to memory and had forgotten that one of those students was actually from Brooklyn, New York, and forgotten probably because he didn't stay the entire year. He was one of those who dropped out in the first year. But there were students from Barkhamsted, Bristol, East Haddam, Mansfield, Coventry, Hartford County, a town, Weetog, and I'm not sure what town that's a section of, but Weetog, Connecticut.
Spell that.
Weetog, Weetogue.
All right.
I said Bristol. There was West Cornwall and Glastonbury as well. Only one person from Mansfield and one from Coventry. Back in 1881.
And you mentioned the Brooklyn connection, to which got me wondering, well, gee, how does somebody in Brooklyn, New York find out about some brand new college in Storrs, or at least Mansfield, Connecticut?
And I'm just speculating here, and it's because Charles and Augustus Storrs were businessmen in Brooklyn, New York. They would mostly, Augustus would spend his summers in Mansfield and attend to his farm, a prize-winning farm, by the way. But they both actually lived in Brooklyn, New York, where they were businessmen.
Weetog is indeed still on the Connecticut map. It is between West Simsbury and Canton, just to the north and west of the city of Hartford. So that still exists out there, and one of the original students was from the borough, if you will, of Weetog, Connecticut. I was sort of having some fun here on the UConn.edu history page, when I found a history quiz. Now, did you write these questions, too?
I was involved in writing the questions. Okay, that was for the 125th anniversary in 2006.
They made a big deal about that, too, I know. So we're going to take the quiz live on the air here. Now, I'll be honest and tell you that I actually took this earlier, and I got 7 out of 10. Okay. Which two brothers founded the institution that would become the University of Connecticut? Lester and Robert Shippey. There's a Shippey Hall on campus. Charles and Augustus Storrs, Lewis and Alexander Beach, and Albert and Nels Jorgensen. Well, we already have identified. You know, it's funny that having seen these quiz questions earlier this morning, you've answered like 5 of these 10 questions just in the course of conversation this morning, including the one about the original Daily Campus was called the Lookout. Anyway, we already know that it's Charles and Augustus Storrs, so we hit the submit button here, and it says, correct. In 1880, Charles and Augustus Storrs offered the state of Connecticut 170 acres of farmland, a former Civil War orphanage, and barns to establish an agricultural school for boys. The school would become the University of Connecticut. Turn the page. Question 2. The University of Connecticut has previously had 4 names in its history. Select the name that is not part of UConn's history. Connecticut State College, Agricultural School of Connecticut, Storrs Agricultural College, Connecticut Agricultural School. I forget what I voted on this earlier on, but this is one I wasn't sure. So I think I said Agricultural School of Connecticut. What do you think, Mark? Is that right or wrong?
I think that's a good guess.
All right, let's click the button here. Correct! UConn has been known as Storrs Agricultural School, Storrs Agricultural College, Connecticut Agricultural College, Connecticut State College, and finally, the University of Connecticut. Sort of the way same Eastern has gone through lots of name changes, too. You mentioned normal schools earlier. Now, this one's a no-brainer. UConn's Husky mascot is named for which Connecticut governor? Jonathan Tremaine, Jonathan McMahon, Jonathan Hollister, Jonathan Trumbull. Obviously, Hollister and McMahon are both dorms on the UConn campus, but we know it's Jonathan Trumbull. So we click on that, and it says, correct, UConn's mascot was named for Jonathan Trumbull, Connecticut's Revolutionary War-era governor from, by the way, nearby Lebanon, Connecticut. The next question, what was the name of the University of Connecticut's first student newspaper? This is one I did not know, and then about 20 minutes ago, Mark had mentioned the Lookout, so now I know what the right answer is. It says it was first published in May of 1896. Well, it gave me the correct answer there. Number 5, this is a 10-question quiz, by the way. Before becoming the Huskies, UConn athletic teams were known as the Panthers, the Minutemen, well, that's UMass, the Blue Men, and the Aggies. I selected Aggies, and I'm correct. When Connecticut Agricultural College became Connecticut State College in 1933, the institution's athletic teams could no longer be called Aggies. The Husky mascot was adopted in 1934.
Right. There's an interesting thing that happened in the 1920s as well, that the football team was referred to as the Orange Men.
Well, I learned this. I remember I was doing a football game up at UMass. By the way, for some reason, this thing isn't triggered. The next question here is taking its time. But anyway, when I was doing a UConn football game up at UMass with Marty Glickman, I found this someplace, and I have not been able to substantiate this in the days of the Internet. So I don't know if it's just an urban legend or what. But when UMass was playing back in the early, well, in my days, they were the Redmen. And like all schools, they got politically correct and didn't want to have that Indian reference, so they changed the name. One of the candidates, instead of Minutemen, which is what they now are, that they considered was the Artichokes. Now, I don't remember why that is. Maybe they grew artichokes out in the fields up there in Amherst, Mass. I don't know.
But, well, isn't there a team out in California known as the Banana Slugs?
I don't know.
I believe it's Santa Clara, the Banana Slugs.
I did not know that. Wow. Mark Roy showing his wide knowledge of sports in general here.
No, limited. Limited. That's the only thing I know about sports. But the Orange Men is an interesting story, so we can talk about that too this morning.
All right. Let me write that down here. Orange Men. O-R-A-N-G-E-M-E-N. And by the way, Syracuse is no longer the Orange Men. They've just made it generic, the Orange. That just happened a couple of years ago. What is the name of UConn's alma mater? UConn Husky, Connecticut U, Old Connecticut, and Varsity. I remember I struggled with this the first time around, too. Now, this is the alma mater, not the fight song. This is the Connecticut. They play it before all the football games. Connecticut. I'm going to go with Old Connecticut. Let's see if this is right here. Are we having fun this morning? Ah, I got it right. Lyrics for Old Connecticut, UConn's cherished alma mater, were penned by University alumna Alice Sowen Davis, class of 1925.
Right.
We think that came up this morning on the air, too. Number seven. In 2004, this is one I didn't know. In 2004, the University of Connecticut successfully completed the largest private fundraising effort ever conducted by a public university in New England. What was the name of this initiative? So I'm looking at the options here. UConn 2000, 21st Century UConn, Campaign UConn, and the Oakleaf Fund. And I thought it was 21st Century UConn. I guess that was earlier. That was before 2004.
A little before that, yes. That was a continuation of UConn 2000 and the rebuilding of the campus.
That's why I was wrong. What is it, the Oakleaf Fund? Is that what it is? It's not the Oakleaf
Campaign Fund. UConn.
Okay. See, I didn't know that either. Well, no, I hit 21st Century UConn. I was wrong. But this says, Campaign UConn, a six-year fundraising initiative, surpassed the initial $300 million goal and raised $471.1 million in gifts and pledges. Question eight, who was UConn's first president? Homer Babbage, I don't think he was first. Albert Jorgensen, I don't think he was first. Benjamin Coons and Charles Beach. And Mark will be the first to tell you, I thought it was Beach. It turns out the answer was, is, and will always be Benjamin Coons, who became principal of Storrs Agricultural School in 1882. This came up earlier today, too. In 1893, his title was changed to president. Michael Hogan is the 14th and current president of the university. Did you change that like right away when Mike became president?
Oh, yes. Oh,
very good. UConn made Division I history by becoming the first university to capture dual championships in which sport? Well, gee, I think we know what that one is. It's Jim and Gino's teams in basketball in 2003 and 2004, and well, they're both number one right now. Maybe it'll happen again this year. This one got me good. How many campuses comprise the University of Connecticut? Okay, so you're talking Storrs. You're thinking Torrington, Stamford, Hartford. And so I came up with like four, and I figured your options are 1, 2, 5, and 8. So I clicked on 5, and it turns out it was very wrong, because it's a total of 8. Now, they're counting the UConn Health Center, for example. They're counting the law school. The answer's not coming up here. It's probably my computer, not your website. But nonetheless, the answer.
But there's Waterbury, and there's Avery Point.
Mark Roy is our guest this morning. What does that title, UConn Media Specialist, mean?
I was afraid you were going to ask that. Actually, it reflects the work that I have done for the university in terms of writing and radio production, television production, and most recently the web.
And anybody who has done any surfing on the UConn website knows how extensive it is. There's great stuff there. And to be honest, I use it a lot when I'm preparing for morning show guests, because anybody from UConn has some kind of a page or sometimes many pages on there, including articles about their work. And it's a terrific resource for me. And the man that kind of is the point person for the entire UConn website is Mark Roy. Now, I'm guessing, Mark, that, you know, when you grew up, you were maybe using slide rules and some of that old technology. Maybe that was me, not you. But nonetheless,
I did use a slide rule, but was not an expert at using a slide rule.
But you can't use one now.
We could do a whole show on what that is and explaining it to people, I'm sure.
That's not for today, though. But I'm kind of curious how this whole webmaster thing evolved in your career at UConn.
In the early 90s, the office that I was in, communications, had gone from what were known as dumb terminals to PCs. And
Dumb terminals?
Well, that was terminals that were hooked up to a central server, and you couldn't print out things on your own. You had to send it to the central server. All of the data was on. We're going to get into a computer history here if I go any further. But basically, what happened was I was starting to post information such as news articles and calendar items up to the university's mainframe computer in what was then known as the Gopher, which was text-based. It was the internet, but it was called Gopher, and it was just text. When the internet and the interface that we now know with pictures and images, et cetera,
audio,
all those sorts of things came along, I made the transition into doing that. We needed someone in the office who could handle those sorts of things. So, yeah, I learned those things along the way.
I'm sure the techies love this stuff. I'm sure that as a guy that does this on a daily basis, you know the answer to this, but what are 1, 2, maybe 3 of the most accessed, the most viewed pages on the UConn website?
The main UConn.edu is one of those. We also have two pages off of there that we've created, one for faculty and staff and one for students. And the one for students is go.uconn.edu. It was redesigned and launched late last summer as go.uconn.edu. And that is one of our most hit internal pages, because that's the page that students go to find out things about announcements and how to log into their email and things like that.
Now, on a day like Monday, for example, when UConn cancels classes, who's the body, who's the person who puts that on the UConn website? Is that you?
That is me. I get a phone call from Jay Hickey in Human Relations, and that the decision has been made, and HR is the place that sends out the message and an email message to folks, but I have to then go into the back end of the website and put in the information that we have a cancellation or a delay.
Or other
that'll probably change over the years. It's probably down the line in the next year or so. That'll become an automated system where someone at HR can just click on something and it'll automatically appear on the page rather than having to give a phone call to me at 4 in the morning.
Our discussion this morning is centered around the history of UConn, and a lot of it was stuff from over 100 years or so ago, stores, agricultural college, and so forth. But what was the event that took place when it officially became the University of Connecticut?
Well, it was the signing of legislation in May of 1939 by Governor Raymond Baldwin, the legislation that approved the name change, and it made, as of July 1st, 1939, that Connecticut State College was now the University of Connecticut. And the university was already in transition. It was growing as a university. Albert Jorgensen had become president in 1935, and that was an important change in the administration of the university. In 1937, at the height of the Depression, he persuaded the legislature to bond nearly $3 million. I'm thinking more in terms today, but $3 million was a lot of money during the Depression, but nearly $3 million in bonding to start building a better campus and stores.
A letter to the editor of the New York Herald signaled early concerns about this little college and stores becoming a state university. The letter, published April 11, 1897, ended with, "The logic of the school, if encouraged, will fasten upon Connecticut a state university for which it has no use and which it cannot afford to maintain."
Well, that was the remnants of what I had talked about earlier about opposition to any kind of state higher education.
You had also mentioned the fact that instead of being the Huskies, it was nearly the Orangemen.
Well, it's actually the change in colors. In the 1920s, the football team was playing other colleges whose colors were blue and white, dark blue and white, as theirs were. And also at that time, I don't think there were teams that had two sets of uniforms for home and away. So you can imagine if everyone's wearing dark uniforms with white lettering, that it would be difficult to find your team members. So they changed their jerseys on the Connecticut team to orange. And so you would find in an article of the student newspaper referring to the football team as the Orange Men, the Blue and White, and Connecticut, all in one paragraph. And at the end of the 1920s, there was a movement among students to change UConn's colors from blue and white to black and orange.
Sort of Halloweenish.
Sort of Halloweenish. And in fact, the 1929 yearbook has as its colors black and orange, anticipating that a change was going to come. Well, there was opposition from the alumni and from other students, and it ultimately, obviously, did not occur. Its colors remained as blue and white, and those have been chosen in the early 1890s.
And Willimantic adopted the black and orange theme for their sidewalks here, or crosswalks in downtown Willimantic. Reading also on your webpage here, it says that the battle, as far as the name, continued 1929, 1930. In the interim, students continued the debate, and it spilled over to state newspapers. Editorials and letters to the editor called for a change of name to Storrs State College or Nathan Hale College, not just Connecticut State. A poll of students in 1931 showed that of 407 who voted, 393 preferred University of Connecticut, and only 14 favored Connecticut State College.
And in 33, they became Connecticut State College. But in the 1920s, there was a movement among students and alumni to get the name changed to Connecticut State College. They weren't quite yet thinking of University of Connecticut, although some were. The Student Drama Club changed their name to the Connecticut State Players. And that raised some eyebrows in Hartford, and they had to change their name back to just Drama Club.
There's some fascinating stuff on the UConn website, much of which written, maybe all of it, by Mark Roy, and I've been thumbing through it this morning. And if you like this topic this morning, we've already had some comments, phone calls, emails from people who appreciate the topic here today, and Mark is so good at what he does here. You can get more detail on this by going to UConn.edu/history and other locations on the UConn website. When did women begin to be students at the University of Connecticut, or whatever the name was at the time?
Officially in 1893, when the name was changed to the Storrs Agricultural College. And what had happened was around 1890-1891, a local girl, Nellie Wilson, had asked President Coons if she might attend some of the classes, non-agricultural classes, history, English, etc. And Coons had been educated at Oberlin College, which was one of the pioneers of co-education, and he looked at the legislation and found that while it was setting up a school for boys, it didn't specifically ban girls from attending the school. And I'm saying girls and boys because we're talking about 15 to 18 year olds. The term teenager had not even been coined yet, I don't believe. And so Nellie Wilson starts taking classes, and she's joined by two others in late 1892, and they graduate in 1894. Even though women weren't officially allowed in until 1893, they graduated from their courses in 1894 and received a certificate.
And the timeline here says three students became the first women to graduate from the Storrs Agricultural College. And you mentioned a local woman, Nellie, apparently is from Mansfield.
Yes.
It's on here, too. And as we wrap things up here with Mark Roy, obviously, we should probably say something about the Dodd Center, because there's a picture of you on the UConn website actually sitting in the Dodd, standing in the Dodd Center there, which is not just a great resource for you, but for many people as
well.
It is.
It has the university's archives. It has many other collections. The New Haven Railroad collection is there. Many collections of alternative press, a fantastic collection of alternative press. But the research collections are fantastic. The university archives, well-maintained, and just a wealth of information and ephemeral items like UConn sweaters and beanies that students used to wear up until the 1970s.
I had my beanie. I don't know where it is anymore, but freshmen used to have to wear beanies. I forget the time frame, but it was at least freshman weekend, maybe. Was it the first month of the year? You had to walk around with that blue and white beanie?
By the late 60s, 1970, when they went out of vogue. I didn't have to buy one when I became a freshman in 1970, but you had to wear them for a certain period of time, whether it was freshman week, but much earlier, in like the 1920s and 30s, freshmen would have to wear their beanie the entire first semester, and if you were caught without it, you could be punished in some way by an upperclassman.
I'd be remiss, too, if I didn't mention that Mark Roy was a big help for me as far as the book that I co-wrote with Bob Porter, because I remember we went to the Dodd Center looking for old pictures of basketball, and you also had a lot of them right there on file in your office, and some of those got used, and you got acknowledged in our book called Hoop Tales, UConn Huskies Men's Basketball. So a couple of authors here in the studio as we've been speaking with Mark Roy.